John Talargato, a retired school teacher and activist critical of compulsory schooling, asserts, "We couldn't purge the best qualities of youthfulness, curiosity, adventure, resilience, the capacity for surprising insight simply by being more flexible about time, texts, and tests, by introducing kids into truly competent adults, and by giving each student what autonomy he or she needs in order to take a risk every now and then. But we don't do that. Between these cinder block walls, we are all expected to be the same. We are trained to ace every standardized test, and those who deviate and see light through a different lens are worthless to the scheme of public education, and therefore viewed with contempt." H.L. Mencken wrote in the American Mercury for April 1924 that the aim of public education is not to fill the young of this species with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The aim is simply to reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent and originality. That is the aim in the United States. To illustrate this idea, doesn't it perturb you to learn about the idea of critical thinking? Is there really such a thing as uncritically thinking? To think is to process information in order to form an opinion. But if we are not critical when processing this information, are we really thinking? Or are we mindlessly accepting other opinions as truth?
Keys, Installment 4, Emergence. Critical thinking question. We are all told in school that this quote-unquote education will open up the world to us and create virtually endless options for our future. So why does it so often feel like the world is being closed off and our options are being diminished? Why does it so often feel as if we're in a tunnel that grows more and more narrow the further we are forced into it? And how do we get out?
It's not a spark in space, an episode of Will and Grace. Controversial yet mundane, Deborah's messing with your brain. Even Scientologists know there's more to all of this. Search the ruins for trapdoors, wonder what you're put here for. Simple as a hint of gas.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast for August 19th, 2010. This is Keys, Installment 4, Emergence. And before I go any further, I just want to apologize for any light wind noise. I am, the hell is that? And truck noise and dog barking noise. I am out on my porch, or potch, as we say here in New England. It is just too nice a day to be inside, so I hope you don't mind. But yeah, I'm going to sit here and do this little introduction. So today, we continue along with the series of non-sequential shows that I call Keys, which are dedicated to investigation, discussion, and, of course, the pursuit of solutions to the very serious problem of state-run education in the so-called United States and around the world. Really, solutions to the problem of any system or institution of education that does not respect the individual needs, desires, sense of purpose, curiosity, or individuality of the learner. I would really like to see all of that just go away peacefully. So I'll start by saying that today's installment of the show is a little bit different than the three shows in this series that precede it. At the very beginning, in the critical thinking question and in the interview you're about to hear, I describe the whole government school experience as similar to the feeling of being trapped in a tunnel that grows increasingly narrow the more we are forced down into it. Now, of course, I'm describing a tunnel that leads to what is considered for most people to be the only option after high school, the 13th grade, huge debts, college. Now, for some people, this makes a lot of sense, but for others, it makes absolutely no sense at all. But the whole tunnel, the whole being trapped in this tunnel is really about cutting off the vastness of options and opportunities that really exist in the world beyond high school. I think we really, really cannot see that when we're stuck there. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a place that is worth trying to get the hell out of as soon as possible, if not physically, you know, emotionally. So, as you know by now, I really don't feel comfortable providing a precise formula for exactly how to do this. I really feel like this needs to be a very personal, individual kind of journey. But what I thought I could do today was provide what I believe to be an excellent example, a story of a young woman who has started to make this journey. Her name, of course, is Erica Goldson. She needs absolutely no introduction by now. In fact, the YouTube video that I played a clip of at the beginning of this show, at the time that I'm putting this MP3 together, had just passed 360,000 views. And that's outstanding. You should go check it out. You can leave comments. The comments there right now, from what I saw, are very, very positive, and that's great news. But as I've mentioned a few times before, I really like to get my money's worth out of words, so I chose to call this show Emergence. Now, that's a word that can mean many different things, but I'm really focusing on three of the definitions here. First, emergence means coming out of or passage out, and that is the either physical or emotional journey out of this tunnel that grows increasingly narrow. Emergence can also mean a beginning, which is the thing that happens next after we get out of that trap, that tunnel, that prison of government school. And in Erica's case, I'll even add a third definition, coming into sight, coming into view. This is somebody who has decided that she is interested and willing to share her experience, her courage, and her hope for the future with hundreds of thousands of people online, which I, you know, as I said in the episode entitled Holes, that this is a really exciting time to be living in because that is just so easy to do today. One of the things that Erica and I discuss in the interview is the feelings that go along with recognizing what is really happening in school and beyond school in the whole adult world that school prepares us to be a quiet and compliant part of. And, you know, these feelings can be frustration, they can be disappointment, it can be fear, and recognizing them and being honest about them and processing them, I think, is a really, really important part of moving forward. Because if we just kind of throw all of this blame at the state or the system, that tends to lead to a lot of anger and a lot of resentment, and that really never leads anywhere productive. And, of course, it's taking the focus away from the only person that we can ever really do anything about in our entire lives, ourselves, and the only time that we really have any control over, the future, and, you know, it focuses it somewhere else. You can't control people who are willing to point guns at you. You just can't. But someday, hopefully, if we start out on this individual quest and enough of us do it, hopefully one day those people won't be there anymore. Now, before I go any further, there's just a couple more things that I would really like to mention related to School Sucks Podcast, and those are one-time donations, significant and very generous one-time donations that I've gotten from a couple of listeners recently. I am absolutely going to butcher one or two of these names, so I apologize, and please feel free to correct me. The first gentleman's name is Abdon Bolivar. Actually, yeah, I nailed that one. That's exactly how that must be pronounced. The other person's name is Heather Rutledal, and I'm not sure about that, but thank you so much for your support of the show. And of course, to all of the people who contribute monthly to the show, even though our productivity slowed down a little bit in the last month, which is definitely a temporary problem, and that's going to pick back up again. Thanks for hanging in there and continuing to contribute a little bit of money every month. It is really greatly appreciated. And of course, you know, the donations that I get every month pay for the cost of doing the show, the bandwidth on Podomatic, the hosting with Media Temple for SchoolSucksProject.com, and, you know, the subscribers bought the bumper stickers that I'm selling now. So I'm actually going to start investing some money into the show. I'm going to buy a mixer, and I'm going to see what I can do about improving the overall sound quality. Now, some of you are probably saying, Brett, what are you, nuts? The show sounds friggin' perfect. You're like an audio wizard. Well, I think there is some room for improvement, and I'm going to look at that. I'd like to see what I could do about making my voice sound a little bit better. Of all the qualities that I really like about myself, my voice annoys the shit out of me. So I want to see if I can fix that. And while we're on that subject of people who help out the show financially, Jason Osborne rolled into town last week, and he took me out to dinner on Monday. Mark Warden, who is another sponsor of the show, he is the Porcupine Realtor. If you want more information about what he does, go to the schoolsucksproject.com support page, and he has a banner at the very, very top of all of the friends of School Sucks podcast. And Gardner Goldsmith from Liberty Conspiracy also joined us. We had a wonderful time in a really beautiful, elegant restaurant in downtown Manchester. And then we came back to my house. We all sat on the porch, and we just had this wonderful powwow for a couple of hours. It was really, really nice. It is so great to have people around where, you know, you're having a conversation where you would rather be listening than talking. I think that that is just terrific, and it was a wonderful time. So thanks to Jason. Thanks to Mark for their support of the show. And without further ado, this interview runs an hour, so I want to get right to it. Thank you very much for listening. I hope this is helpful. I look forward to your feedback. Have a great day and take care.
Our motivational force ought to be passion, but this is lost from the moment we step into a system that trains us rather than inspires us. We are more than robotic bookshelves conditioned to blurt out facts we were taught in school. We are all very special. Every human on this planet is very special. So aren't we all deserving of something better? Of using our minds for innovation rather than memorization, for creativity rather than futile activity, for rumination rather than stagnation. We are not here to get a degree to then get a job so we can consume industry-approved placation after placation. There is more and more still. The saddest part is that the majority of students don't have the opportunity to reflect as I did. The majority of students are put through the same brainwashing techniques in order to create a complacent labor force working in the interests of large corporations and secretive government. And worst of all, they are completely unaware of it.
You could do better, you could be the greatest man in the world. You could do better, you could do better, you could be the greatest man in the world.
My guest today is Erica Goldson, who was the valedictorian at Coxsackie Athens High School for the year 2010. But more importantly, she gave a speech at the graduation that she entitled, Here I Stand. I actually read it in the last episode of School Sucks podcast. And I am really excited to have you here, Erica, and look forward to talking with you about your experience.
Good. I look forward to it, too.
So the first thing, and I know you said you had gotten this question before, this is a pretty articulate indictment of the public education system in this country. And for you to be able to realize all of these things while you were still in school is pretty amazing, I think. And like I said in the previous show, I was really inspired by the speech. But how did you start to come to these realizations, and when, about what was really going on in school?
Well, I have to say, definitely my 10th grade English class opened my eyes a lot. I remember starting off the school year learning about the literacy rate in America and how incredibly low it is. I guess that really opened my eyes, first of all, for a teacher to even start talking about how students aren't as smart as we really thought we were. You know, we thought if we're getting good grades, we're doing really well, but that really isn't the case. Grades don't define a brain at all. And especially throughout that year, we learned a lot about social justice issues, and my teacher introduced a lot of philosophy to us, which really hadn't been introduced the way she did. Maybe through social studies, we would learn some names, but we really wouldn't delve into what these people actually studied and came up with, and we wouldn't debate about ideas. But in this class, we really did get into that kind of stuff.
And that, you could say that that gets you thinking too, obviously, because while school is so much about answers and conclusions that are kind of imposed upon you, philosophy is very much about questions. And that is a, it seems like it would be a really good way to get people thinking in ways that are, you know, that are a real departure from what is typical in school.
Yeah, that's definitely true. School is usually the teacher asking you a question and you have to come up with the right answer. But then when you're thinking philosophically, you're coming up with the questions and there might not even be a right answer. Other than that, though, I would have to say I just started questioning a lot throughout my high school experience. I remember getting really depressed almost about why I was in such a situation and wondering why I was doing what I was doing, why I cared about grades when other people didn't, and where it was going to get me in life. I'd always been told that it would get me to college, and, you know, a good college would get me a good job. And also, you know, starting to see how that wasn't true and how the economy starts crashing obviously opened up my eyes a lot more and made me feel very unprepared for life.
Yeah, because it seems like everything they're telling you is really just about getting the next carrot down the bunny trail, so to speak. And mm-hmm. there's really nothing in it for you. And I've talked a lot on my show in the past about intrinsic motivation. Now, obviously, one of the things that we're trying to avoid in school is the stick or the punishment. You know, we're told to be good for this because these are the rules or this is the way it has to be. But, you know, the other side of that, too, is that everything that's motivating us, everything that is a so-called reward, is really not something that, that we're seeking. It's something that's kind of being dangled in front of us. And I felt like, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I feel like that, you use the word depressed. I think that everything being extrinsic as far as motivation is concerned, it tends to leave young people feeling pretty hollow, feeling pretty empty, whether they're the overachiever or the underachiever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I actually listened to that podcast that you had talking about my speech earlier, and I remember you talking about that empty feeling, and I totally agreed. I had that same empty feeling, and then you went into marijuana, and I totally agreed again because I started smoking pot as well. I was getting so frustrated with life that I just had to kind of escape. And, you know, I was able to do that and still go back to school during the week and, you know, get my good grades and keep doing what I was doing just because I felt that I had already gotten so many good grades during my whole life. Why give up now? You know, at least maybe I can just end it after high school and everything will be fine.
Right.
So yeah, I definitely agree. The education system made me feel I was only valuable if I was doing what they told me I should be doing. And I never could find any value in myself apart from that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have that problem. Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that because I was pretty much in high school the classic underachiever. And those kind of things, as I was mentioning in that show, you know, the holes that I felt really, they weren't going to be filled with other people's rewards. They were going to be filled, and I think it was true for a lot of people, with behavior that is disrespectful to the self. And in some cases, even self-abusive. When I look at a lot of the things that I read, and a lot of the things that I hear about, and a lot of the things that I participated or I witnessed when I was in school or when I was a teacher, yeah, the hole is deep. And I think that it's interesting to hear you say that you kind of understand a little bit of both sides of it, because I think usually people, once they get on that trajectory, they're just pushed and pushed and pushed, and they don't fall in. I guess that's kind of a generalization, but they tend to avoid some of those temptations to feel whole, or at least to kind of, I don't know, numb the pain of that emptiness. And what about your peers? What about your friends? Did you ever try to address any of these things, or bring what you were feeling to their attention, specifically about school or about the whole adolescent experience?
I think once I started writing the speech, I would talk to some people about it because they didn't really understand where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I was willing to share with them. But mostly, I wouldn't really bring it up. I'm not inclined to talk about more important matters unless someone else is really interested in it. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to just tell my friends, you know, in the middle of talking about shoes or something, you know, I'm supposed to say, oh, by the way, our education system sucks and, you know, your grades don't mean anything, you know?
Yeah.
But also I wanted to mention, talking about peers at school, a big influence was probably all the foreign exchange students that would come in and out of our school. There was actually a woman that lived down the street from me that takes in foreign exchange students each year. So they would always come to our school and they would always talk about our education system and how easy it is. And, you know, it would make me feel stupid. Like, what am I worth now? You know, if just because that I'm number one in the class doesn't mean anything, because in Germany, I might be nothing. I might be in third grade in Germany, you know?
Right. And I always, you know, I do understand that other countries have education systems that are considered to be far superior to the American system. But again, when you think about what we've realized about education, I would want to know, and I would really want to look at it closely, superior by what metrics? I mean, I know they would say in Japan, that's a far, far superior system to the American government education system, but what's motivating them? You know, I think that what's important about education is that it's not a predetermined or defined amount of years that we spend going in and out of a building with other people telling us what is important to learn about and what we can and can't do and when we're right and when we're wrong. It's more of a lifelong process of pursuing knowledge based on our own interests, based on our own purpose, based on our own intrinsic motivation. So I don't think that governments anywhere in the world get education right by that definition. And I know that even though in Japan they certainly are pumping out more engineers and scientists, the suicide rate in a lot of the countries with, you know, quote, superior education systems is considerably higher than it is here. And even as you go to more competitive places around the country, I know you live in New York, I used to work in Massachusetts in the Boston area, and there were some, you know, really what they considered top-notch public schools, and there was a lot of suicides there over, you know, the pressure to, well, I mean, you know, suicide is complicated and I'm sure there's many, many factors, but they were saying that a lot of these kids just felt so much pressure that at 17 or 18 years old, they had just said that they had had enough. And I thought that was so tragic. But I think that, sure, our education system around the world is kind of a joke, but first of all, what were these exchange students, what were their, you know, primary complaints about it?
Well, I remember especially dealing with the sciences. You know, I had a student say that, I didn't even take physics, but I had a student say that our physics class was a joke and very elementary, and he learned these things in, you know, third grade or whatever. And then I actually started becoming very interested in physics when I would talk to him and I would ask him questions. And I guess it started annoying me also that it wasn't required for us to take physics. I think that, you know, especially like chemistry and physics are things that we don't learn enough about when we're growing up. It's mostly biology. And those two subjects definitely explain a lot about how the world works. And also, if you get deeper into those sciences, you'll realize that the answers aren't all there, and that's why it's so tricky, and you'll realize that, you know, you have to come up with your own ideas at some point, and you have to actually start thinking. So, yeah, I mean, it was mostly the sciences, but I also remember something interesting. One of the students from Hong Kong took our ELA Regents, which is the 11th grade Regents, and passed with a 67, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, that's his second language. And that's 11th grade for us. We've been speaking it our whole lives. And he had been speaking it, I don't know, maybe a year. I'm not sure exactly how long. But I just know that test, like, even me taking it, I got 100. It was the easiest thing. It was something that we were trained to do. It wasn't something that we had to think about at all.
Right. And I think that's interesting, too, what you say about the sciences, because one thing that I've always said to kids when I was working with them as a tutor is that most of the math, you know, depending on what you want to do, if it's not in some kind of science or math field, then most of the stuff that you're going to learn past 10th grade in both of those subjects is useless as far as, you know, real life applications is concerned. But what does exist in those subjects is an opportunity to, exactly what you were saying, to learn how to think and solve problems and reason in ways that most of the rest of school, you're just kind of being force-fed. But the closer I even looked at those subjects, math was very much about formulas. Like, I always talk to kids about things like, an example that I probably mentioned on the show before, the distance formula. Why does this formula tell you how long a line is on an XY graph? And as far as most kids are concerned, it's like a magic trick that complicated formula under the square root sign tells you the length of a line, and they don't even understand that what they're looking at is the Pythagorean theorem. So much of it is not even about thinking where the opportunities to think are. They are just given formulas, and I've even dealt with frustration from kids in the past where they said, like tutoring for the SAT, which is very much about critical thinking, and they get angry and they say, I've never been shown how to do this. I don't have a formula for this. So even where the opportunities to think critically and to employ and develop some logical reasoning skills exist, they're kind of being squandered just by the rote instruction. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely understand what you're talking about, because we really are just trained for a test. So if all we need to know for a test is the formula, then why learn anything else? We really don't value actual learning because the system doesn't value learning.
Right.
And
even on the SAT, I remember just memorizing. Well, I mean, I guess I was just really good at memorizing, so I would have the formulas down. And I mean, you just have to really remember a lot. I did pretty well on the math section, but I really think it was more because of my memorization skills.
I think too that, just back to the foreign exchange students for a second, people who are coming from countries where, you know, maybe the education system has put more emphasis on the sciences. One thing that I will say, and it's not really a positive when you're just kind of molding the minds of people, it's hard to frame this as something positive, but the public education system, since its inception, has been somewhat in line as far as what it's preparing students for with what the economic needs of the country were. So obviously when it was set up 150 years ago, now they missed a big chance throughout the 80s and the 90s to prepare for this information world where, and obviously they've always failed at helping people become entrepreneurs. But from the start, when the system was set up, it was an industrial economy. Most people worked in factories, so they needed to know how to sit still. They needed to know how to follow directions and do simple tasks. Now, it never really changed, but I think what most people are being prepared for now is to work in, you know, a service economy. In retail, it's like that's where most of the jobs seem to be right now. So can you be polite and follow other people's instructions and perform simple tasks? It's pretty much the same thing, but all it's really preparing people for is sort of, you know, menial type jobs, or at best, you know, sitting in a cubicle and performing tasks that are assigned. So
yeah, I completely agree with that. I was going to bring up the point as well that a country, just preparing its citizenry for the economic needs, and, you know, America's economic needs aren't philosophers or scientists, unless they're working in the interests of corporations, of course.
Yeah, and I think it's getting to a point, well, it depends, like, America's economic needs, which is something that we hear a lot, but it's very vague, and we would have to think that what America's economic needs really means is what corporations need, and what they need, like you said in your speech, is pretty much like a compliant labor force that's not going to rock the boat, that's not going to ruffle feathers, that's basically going to do what they're told. Of course, there's also, despite what happens in the economy, despite how many people are unemployed, the government is always growing, and there's always more jobs in state and federal governments, and those aren't thinking jobs, working in some bureaucracy. So yeah, I mean, I guess we could say that the public education system is preparing young people to meet the economic needs of America, when those economic needs are determined by the state itself and by, you know, the corporations that sort of swing from its umbilical cord.
Yeah, and of course, also another economic need of our country is soldiers. And I think that a lot of students that don't do well in school, then their only option is to, you know, go fight a war. And that's how they'll be paid, because they don't have a degree to certify anything, which is another problem, that we need certification to prove that we're something.
Mm-hmm.
They've never, like you said, they've never been taught entrepreneurial skills, and now they just need something in order to pay the bills. And unfortunately, it's a very gloomy scenario that they are forced into.
Right. And these are all products, you know, everything that we've been talking about, of people who have been trained to be obedient, which is great for the military and, you know, a lot of other government jobs, or people who've been trained to be dependent, who would fear the idea of becoming an entrepreneur, who would be terrified of not having some large corporation that's going to, you know, give them a pension or pay for their health insurance or pay for them to go to the dentist. Training independence makes those things really frightening, I think, for a lot mm-hmm. of people.
I was definitely scared of that. I was scared of independence. Now that I'm coming into adulthood, I was scared that I'm not going to be able to pay the bills if I don't go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they tell me. So then, luckily, I did some research and realized that there are alternatives and there are communities that work together, and like the one I'm staying at right now, and they really cooperate for the common good of all the people in the community, and they live just fine. And independence isn't as important in this type of scenario. So I guess that's an important piece of information to let people know, is that there are alternatives if you're willing to look. And the only scenario isn't the one that you're told throughout your schooling. There are other options.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's endless options for, you know, the directions that our lives can go after we finish this 12-year process of public schooling. I think it feels, as we move forward, especially through our final years of high school, that it's just, we're in this tunnel that's getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And at the end, when we squeeze through to get out, the only option is college or, you know, complete and utter failure. So I think that the world school in many ways closes off, you know, the vastness and the opportunity and the options that really exist in the world. Most people don't see that. All they see is the 13th grade, because that's what everybody else is doing. That's what their mm-hmm. teachers' expectations are. That's what the guidance counselor's expectations are. That's what their parents' expectations are, because that's what they did. I remember for myself not wanting to go to college and almost finding a way out of it. You know, the circumstances at the time, this was 1995 when I graduated from high school. The situation just wound up being that I went to college, and I remember going and thinking, yeah, this was really the best thing that I could have done. Now, obviously, I think it would have made more sense to maybe experience the world a little bit first than just kind of going back into this fantasy land of continued childhood and dependence. Not that there's anything wrong with college, and if people know what they want to do and they're focused on a goal or they have a career in mind, I think it's a fine option if they're ready to incur the debt. But I think a lot of people just go because it's what's expected of them, and they wind up wasting time and money, and 4 years later, they still might be terrified, because then they're really in the real world, except now they just have a bunch of debt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and a lot of people tell me, you know, if you go to college, then you'll at least have time to figure out what you want to do, you know, take a lot of different classes and figure it out doing that. But I don't think that figuring out what I want to do is worth $40,000 a year,
right,
or whatever it may be, you know, like maybe I could travel a little bit. That might be a wee bit cheaper than the college tuition and room and board and all that, just for taking some classes and figuring something out.
Yeah, and at least that way too, maybe after a couple years. This is why one of the things that I do is college consulting, and I've never really been very good at it, because I present these options and they're just so foreign to people. Like, not go to college right away? are you crazy? I even remember my dad telling me when I was, you know, contemplating doing some other things, traveling. I wanted to go on tour with the Grateful Dead because that's where I was at. But then, you know, the Grateful Dead basically came to an end the summer I was a senior in high school. After I was a senior in high school, so college became the only option. But I remember my dad even saying to me, Brett, you'll get a job somewhere, you'll make $10 an hour, and you'll think you're rich, and then you'll still be working there 20 years later. And, you know, that kind of sucked. And I thought maybe from his experience that it would just make sense to take his advice and take my mother's advice, and that was their expectation for me, and I should go. But if I had had a couple years to experience the world and maybe try out a couple of jobs, maybe when I was 20 or 21, I could have gone into college with more of a purpose. I mean, I majored in communications, which is a completely useless degree. The entire industry was revolutionized while I was in school. So when I graduated in 2000, what I had was completely worthless. And, you know, a little bit more planning and a little bit more foresight, I think I would have done things a lot differently.
Yeah, in high school, I heard how in Ireland, they actually encourage students to take a year off before college, and I thought how difficult it would actually be in America, especially with the carrot and stick when they give you scholarships as you're coming out of high school. Those scholarships aren't going to be good if you decide to take a year off. And, you know, I've also heard things about if you're in university and you have a scholarship, you can't take a leave of absence without that affecting the scholarship, at least for some schools. And it really is like a way to trap people within the system by using money.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the cost of college, I think, has risen 10 times faster than, you know, the cost of other things relative to inflation. Or the only other thing that's even really keeping pace with education is the cost of healthcare. And part of the problem is that so much money is made available and looks easy to get to go to college that a lot of people who are graduating from high school and don't understand debt, which is the same reason, you know, credit card companies used to line up at colleges to try and give kids these high interest credit cards, is that people are very willing to incur $100,000 and $120,000 in debt just to do what they feel is the next right thing or the next expected thing, you know, at that point in their life. And like I said, it's the same thing. The options become so narrowed by what we're told and what we experience and what's kind of foisted upon us in high school. People don't even see how big the world is and how many options they have.
Yeah, and it seems like you can just get a loan. That's what everyone else is doing. Everything will be fine. And that's another problem within our education system is that we're not thoroughly taught about the financial world and how it actually operates and what a loan really means for our economy and who's benefiting and who's losing in this game. We're never taught anything like that.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't remember much math having to do with money in school, like maybe how to make change if you buy something. But the concept of credit, sure, we might have learned how to calculate interest rates at some point, but the implications of taking on debt are never really explained. And of course, you know, there's lots of people lining up to prey on what young people don't know as they exit high school, or even while they're in high school, as I mentioned in the last show. Now, one of the things that I was also interested in asking you about, and we covered this a little bit, but just so I can have a time frame, how much time do you think you actually spent in school where you were really aware that something was wrong? I know you said that it was a gradual process, but did it get to a point where you were sitting there and you're just like, I am completely aware of what I'm involved in and how this is not only unnatural, but really kind of, you know, working against my intellect and working against my purpose? And how much time was that you felt that way?
I would have to say definitely in the last half of my senior year when college was approaching so rapidly and I really had to start making a decision, I broke down completely. I knew, like, you know, tears. I was under so much pressure. From then on, like, I knew that that what I was doing could possibly go nowhere, and I didn't know what to do, and I just started blaming it all on the system, really. Like, and I really got into sociology, and I was taking I remember last semester I was taking a social problems course and an economics course at the same time, and they were overlapping a lot, and my mind was just going crazy thinking about our economy and all the problems with it and the problems with the education system. And I definitely started doing a lot of research. I was reading John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Mm-hmm. That opened my eyes a lot. I think I kind of already knew, like, I knew the basics, like, everything was working in the interests of government and corporations, but I didn't know the specifics that Perkins actually talked about in the book of how it worked. So, yeah, it was me freaking out and then starting to pick up materials to learn more about it, I guess.
And it can be very disempowering, too, I think, when we start to realize these things. And, you know, this is one of the motivations behind the show, even though even I tend to get caught up in the negativity sometimes. It can be very disempowering to realize these things without kind of having any idea of what to do about it, because it's certainly easy to blame the system. And of course, the system, you know, in quotes, whatever we're using that word to mean, it does have a lot of culpability in what happens to us while we're growing up, the school system. And of course, when we're adults, there's all other kinds of inhuman systems that, you know, come into play and have a lot of control over our lives. But, you know, the system never sends you a sympathy card. The system never reaches out to hug you and apologize. And that's what I'm saying. It's just, it kind of pulls power away from people when they get stuck in this idea of this is, you know, so powerful and so cold. And I always encourage people to kind of focus on the idea that there's nothing you can do about people who are willing to use deception or people who are willing to use threats or theft or violence in the past or the present. And living in that world is very difficult and, like I said, very disempowering. The only person that we're ever going to have any significant control over is ourselves, and the only time that we're really ever going to be able to affect is the future. So, you know, our future. So while I think that it's an important first step to understand what has happened to us and what is happening to us, there comes a time where you either just kind of get eaten up by that frustration, or you say, all right, the only person that I'm ever going to have any control over is myself. And, you know, the only direction that I can really go is forward. And I think it helps ease some of that discomfort once you start, because it's very uncomfortable. You know what I mean? When you start to realize these things.
Mm-hmm. Definitely uncomfortable. Gosh, I would say it's even more than uncomfortable. It's scary. It's, I don't know the word to describe it. It's just so overwhelming when you, especially talking about the system, that's what I would blame it on. But then I wouldn't actually like understand who are the people working within the system. And what I realized is they're people like you and me. And what I couldn't wrap my head around was how people could be in such power and do such horrible things to children by knowing the agenda of education and still subjecting children to that because they just view them as workers and part of the economy and just really an asset to the whole scheme of America. And I could never put myself in that person's shoes, or, you know, multiple people's shoes that are controlling everything. And that was really disheartening as well.
But I understand what you're saying, and I think that when I talk about the real agenda of the school system, or, you know, the treatment of adolescents, especially, you know, in the last 15 or years within the psychiatric community, with just laying drug after drug on top of the population for these very, very questionable ailments that don't even constitute actual diseases. And you would say, how could people participate in such evil? And you start to feel, and you certainly start to sound to people who are willfully ignoring all of this, as if you're some kind of conspiracy theorist. But the truth is, when you say they're people like you and me, I think you're right that there is no conspiracy. I think most of the people have no idea what they're really involved in, or they are so indoctrinated that they believe that what they're involved in is virtuous or noble. And I think when some of the reality starts to confront them, especially after, you know, spending 10 or 15 years as a teacher in the public education system, they start telling themselves stories that what they're doing is good, that what they're doing is virtuous. I think politicians do this. I think, you know, the police do this. I think soldiers do this. Very, very few people seem to have the courage to make the choice to change directions. And the more they're confronted with, the louder the storytelling voice gets for them. And it's a real cognitive dissonance that they deal with. They don't want to confront what they're involved in or the reality of what they're involved in. I mean, obviously, if you ever have a conversation with somebody about the state itself, about the military, or, you know, certain things about government, people will fight you. People will attack you. I mean, not physically, but everything but. It's personal for them. And they will turn around and they will attack you on a personal level because you are making them so damn uncomfortable because they've decided that this is where they feel comfortable. And if you're going to interfere with that comfort zone, all they can do is run away or attack you, really.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I've experienced that before, trying to talk about serious subjects, and you can't even get through to them. It seems like they're just so, I mean, I try to use this word lightly, but I feel like some people are so brainwashed, and so much propaganda is thrown out there, like support the troops and the police are good for you. And it just, once you actually start thinking about it and wondering what they're really doing, it's a totally different world, and it's hard to connect with some people about those issues.
Yeah, and as you kind of learn more and you can bring more facts to the table and you can bring more questions up to people that they can't answer, and you can, you know, polish your debating skills a little bit, you start to realize that trying to bring people the truth about a lot of these issues, or trying to get them to see a lot of these topics from a different point of view, that what we're doing is not intellectual. It's not an intellectual pursuit at all. It's emotional. It's psychological. It's not like what you're saying is completely incomprehensible. I believe in many cases, the resistance and the fight and the attack is because they already know that you're right, and they've always known. And that voice is quieted, you know, by the voice that tells the story. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, as I read your speech, and I read it over a couple times, and I, you know, I saw the video on YouTube and I watched a little bit of it, but it was very hard to gauge the audience reaction to what was happening. So I was kind of interested, while we're on this topic, what was the reception, or more importantly, what was the one-on-one feedback that you got after you delivered this speech?
Well, it was funny. Actually, one of the kids in my class, as everyone was sitting down and I was walking back to my seat after the speech, you know, gave me a high five. Uh-huh. So that felt pretty good. After the graduation ceremony, no one came up to me with any bad remarks. Everyone came up to me with open arms, saying that they were very impressed and I was awesome and they can't believe I did that. And, you know, the people that didn't like it just kept to themselves and probably talked about it with other people that didn't like it. But I never heard any bad things from anyone. I only heard through the grapevine who didn't like it and whatnot. And even the people that didn't like it, if I would see them later during the summer and I would say hi or anything, you know, they would just be polite as normal and just never bring up the issue, really.
I think that when you discover these things about school, and then you say, okay, well, if this most treasured and noble institution, as we've always been told, works like this, you know, what other truth lies beyond this? Because if we're educated to not think, if we're indoctrinated to believe all these things that are false, what lies beyond this whole experience? Like, what is all of this trying to hide? And like you said, when you start to discover those things, yeah, it's frustrating, but it's beyond frustrating. It can be intimidating. And it can be saddening. And I think what makes it worse at first, and this does get better, and it gets easier to deal with, is that many of the superficial relationships that you have in your life will dissolve. And people will start, once they realize that you understand these ideas and you're telling the truth and you can articulate fact after fact to back up this conclusion, they will run away from you in all directions if they're not attacking you. And it sounds like, you know, that's kind of, I mean, I don't want to put you know, words in your mouth, but it sounds like that's what you're describing, that no one came up after the speech, you know, especially teachers or administrators, and said, that was outrageous, you should be ashamed of yourself, and people just seem to steer clear of you. They know that you are right.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, but I mean, I wish they knew I was right and then also was more motivated by my speech to actually change. But I don't know, like, it's really, some people are just content with their lives, you know, they're content with their jobs and the pay they get, and they really don't want to change anything. But I guess once their house gets foreclosed, maybe then they'll want to change something.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah.
And, you know, the other part of it, too, is that there could have been a number of teachers and administrators who sat in the audience and listened to you talk. And obviously you were a student there and you were successful by all of the metrics they set up. So it wasn't like they could treat you like some insane person who just ran up to the podium and started barking some strange nonsense. They had to listen, and they knew who you were, and they could have sat there and said, boy, she is really, you know, like hitting the mark here with all of this, and I felt that way, and that is true. But people also have a tendency to retreat. I have had conversations with older people, people my parents' age, many, many times where, you know, within a half an hour or an hour of discussion on some topic, I can pretty much convince them, I thought, beyond a reasonable doubt of, you know, my position. And they would concede and they would say, yeah, I agree with you. But then they retreat back to the world, like I was talking about, where they feel comfortable. That your speech, the memory of what you said will get quieter and quieter as they drown it out with, you know, their Fox News or their New York Times or whatever kind of reinforces that belief system that gives them so much serenity for whatever reason. So in the speech, there was a part towards the end where you addressed the people who were kind of being left behind. Like, you were luckily out. This was it. But one of the things that I was really interested in speaking with you about was what kind of, for lack of a better word, advice would you want to provide for people who are starting to realize these things that you realized, but they still have to, for whatever reason, they don't feel like they can leave, they don't want to homeschool or unschool, they still have to endure a couple years of this. Like, what would you say to them?
Well, I guess I would definitely say start up conversation with people. I mean, it's hard. I think that asking questions is a good piece of advice too. Anything that you hear, if there's any type of doubt in your mind, just ask questions and kind of, you know, if you feel like someone isn't telling the truth, asking questions will corner them into a lie, and they'll be exposed if they're willing to try to answer the questions, you know. But what other advice?
Well, do you think that the time would be best spent where you, of course, I totally agree that it's just a, you know, a series of well thought out questions that can collapse just about any false or nonsensical belief system. While there is certainly some value in questioning the authorities in the school, the people who are only looking to get answers out of you and not questions, is it also, in your opinion, worth engaging peers? Or is that even more important, to be having these conversations with people who are in the same situation?
Yeah, definitely engaging peers. It's hard, though. It's hard because a lot of classrooms suppress discussion, which is really sad. I was really looking forward to high school, I remember, because especially in English class, I always pictured, like, just talking about what we've read and having really good discussion. But that didn't happen as often as I would like. But I mean, when it did happen, if some students were able to bring up something I've never heard of, that was really important to me. And it helped me form my ideas and start understanding what I now understand. Just little references anytime someone can get something in. But it's not like at the lunch table, many of your peers are talking about politics.
Did you feel like it was hard to have a meaningful conversation with peers?
I don't think I even really tried. It was mostly like, I hardly even knew what I was going through. And I was going through a time where I was feeling like I didn't know anything. I was like, everything I've learned is fraud. I need to start reevaluating everything and start learning. So it was completely unnecessary to even really talk to most of my peers about it, because they wouldn't even understand and they wouldn't be able to help me. And it's really hard just finding people that can help you. But I guess this is a good piece of advice. Start a club. Because I actually co-founded a club in 10th grade, and it dealt with human rights issues and social justice issues and prejudice, and really trying to educate my school about it. And it was really hard to get members for the club at first. But then as more students became aware of the club and its purpose, and we were getting out there doing like bake sales and exposing ourselves, then slowly students started becoming interested, and then you can be around students that have similar views as you. So I would definitely say, if you have an interest and you want to talk to your peers about it, it would help to start a club.
Maybe even a debate club. Where some of these issues could be brought to light and discussed, and that would be the whole purpose. Just to jump back to what you said a couple of minutes ago, can you give me an example of how you felt that the classroom environment actually suppressed discussion?
Oh, because, you know, raise your hand, like the oldest rule in the book, and students don't even want to raise their hand. And the fact that students are so scared to be wrong, they don't want to discuss ideas because there's only one right answer. That's what they're trained to think. And most students are just completely bored too. So they're not even in the mood for a discussion. They just kind of want to sleep or draw or whatever, take their mind off of what they're supposedly learning, because they don't even feel like it's worth anything anymore. So they just ignore everything that's going on in the classroom.
And you probably think that even if somebody, a lot of the times, if somebody does have something that they want to say, in addition to the fear of having the answer that isn't the one right answer, there's also the apprehension about being judged by the other people in the class. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say so. And also, the way it's structured, with the teacher being the authority.
Mm-hmm.
That makes students feel like that their teacher is superior, their teacher is the know-all on the subject, and really, in some cases, teachers really just teach out of a textbook. Not all teachers do this, but I've noticed a handful that will really just teach out of a textbook and don't really know anything more than the textbook, but students think that they are the ultimate authority on the subject, which, you know, sometimes it's good for people to admit that they don't know everything and let students know that their students can actually teach them as well. And, you know, maybe the teacher has a lot of experience in the field and is ready to share all their knowledge with their students, but they want their students to discuss it with them and try to, I don't know. It's always good if a teacher's open to criticism.
What would be a class where you felt like a teacher was just really, teaching out of the book and didn't have much knowledge beyond what was in the book? Which, if kids don't think that the teacher is the ultimate authority, in many cases they think that the book is the ultimate authority.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, well, I definitely noticed my social studies class.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed like it was definitely out of the book a lot, and questions out of the book. And I'm sure there are a lot of social studies teachers that know a great amount of history, but the sad part is it's so controversial for them to even bring up anything outside of the book that they can't even show, give students their knowledge. I remember I decided not to take an AP European history class. I decided not to. Instead, I would just take the normal global history class, and then I would compare it with the students that were taking the AP Euro. And they said, and even though it was the same teacher teaching both classes, when he was teaching the AP Euro, which was mostly the more advanced, you know, smarter kids or whatever, mm-hmm. he was able to say more about the world and how it works. Instead of our global class, he kind of taught more out of the book. So I guess I kind of, that's it.
Yeah. Do you feel comfortable, just back to this, providing some ideas for people who are stuck in the system, do you feel comfortable suggesting that people who are still in school challenge their instructors or challenge the system the way you mentioned in your speech, as far as, you know, demanding that you need to know this for the test is not good enough?
Oh, I think maybe a handful of students may do that, but I don't think very many will, just because they might not feel like it really they have much power.
It's a pretty powerless feeling and position when we're in school. And I think because they can really only see themselves in the context of that whole environment, and they see the authorities, and they see all their peers. And you did something that really seemed to demonstrate to me, you know, a tremendous amount of personal power and self-confidence and courage. And how would you, you know, how would you recommend that other people try to do something like that? It's a tough question, I know.
How would I recommend they do that? Well, I definitely recommend that they do that, for one, because so many people have been saying that I'm so courageous, but, you know, I hope it's more of motivation for other students to do the same thing and realize that it is possible to speak your mind with little repercussion, and actually some good consequences as well. You know, maybe showing them that you can become internet famous will make them want to speak out a lot more. But also, you know, it's not speaking out just for the purpose of causing a ruckus, of course, right. But definitely it's just a search for knowledge, and no one should ever be scared to speak their mind when they really want to learn something. How should they do it? I don't know. Through practice, I guess. I think the way I was able to start speaking my mind was through writing. In my English assignments, I always felt like my voice was so much stronger when I could write an essay about it, and I wasn't afraid to be sassy. Or, you know, I remember my English teacher would say that I was sassy all the time, like with all my papers. And I took that as a huge compliment. Like, I'm telling it like it is, and I don't mind because it's just a paper.
Right.
But then, you know, I start really thinking about it, and I'm about to write a whole speech, and I kind of just wrote it like I would write a paper. And then when I came to the point where I realized I actually had to say it, that was what kind of got me. That was what made me really nervous. But at the same time, I knew, like, I already wrote it. I have it in front of me. All I have to do is read it. It'll be fine, you know? So definitely through certain, I guess even students could do this through art as well. It doesn't have to be writing. It could be through music. It could be through anything that they're interested in, through drama. They can speak their mind. So it really doesn't have to be just words and looking someone in the eye, because that can be very intimidating.
But kind of like suggesting that people find their own channels to slowly, really gradually is fine. Like like you were saying, it doesn't have to happen all at once. It doesn't have to be some kind of big event, but just start to slowly reestablish their sense of self that has been kind of crushed for so long, to find their own voice. And through doing that, I think that people can realize a great deal of personal power. But they also, if this is happening in school, and it is confrontational and it is challenging, I think any doubts that they have about the real intentions of the system, the real intentions of the system will be revealed to them as they start to step out of line, even just a little bit, as I think we've all learned in one way or another.
Yeah, because the only way you're going to start learning and connecting with others on an issue is if you step out a little bit and say something, and then someone will recognize you and say, hey, I can totally teach you things and you can teach me things and we can have a conversation. That's exactly what's happening to me. You know, like, I stepped across the line and now my speech is all over and people are just messaging me all throughout Facebook saying, hey, you know, I noticed that you're enlightened and I'm enlightened too, so let's have a conversation and let's fix the world. You know, that would have never happened if I hadn't written that speech.
So you're happy. I remember last night you saying that you had, you used Martin Luther King as far as like the potency of the speech that you wanted to give. And like I mentioned in the last show, 15 years ago, yeah, great speech, but no one ever would have known anything about it beyond, you know, the auditorium or the football field or wherever the graduation was. And it just would have maybe been memorable to a few people. But after that, regardless of its content, it would have just sort of faded into the ether. And now this is something that is having, you know, a real effect on a lot of people. And it's very inspirational. And I think it's really exciting, the time that we live in, where a graduation speech at a small school in, you know, suburban or even, I guess it's kind of rural where you are, rural New York.
Yeah, pretty rural.
could get, as good as it is, could attract so many people and inspire so many people and create such a buzz online. It shows you, I think, that you are so, so not alone with this stuff. And so much about high school, from what I remember it, is we, you know, we gravitate to these superficial, clicky friendships, and we find ourselves in these sort of shallow and frustrated romantic relationships, all related towards dealing with that loneliness that's just come upon us as we've become adolescents. And I think that as I talk about, you know, getting your own sense of self and getting this personal power back, there was a psychologist, Nathaniel Brandon, who I remember reading or listening to something he said once, and he said, we're all lonely, but first and foremost, it's kind of a loneliness for ourselves. Do you know what I mean? We lose ourselves in all of this. And it really is a struggle to get it back. It's a long road, like I said. I'm certainly still on it. But it's very, very satisfying to first realize how some of this stuff happens. And it's very rewarding to start to correct it.
Yep, I totally agree.
So, Erica, before we wrap up, there was a mention in your speech of a teacher that you had, an English teacher. And I think you've mentioned her a couple times already in our discussion. But because I tend to really, really just deal with the negative aspects of the government school system, I do forget to explain sometimes that there are certainly good, hardworking people that exist within that system. And I've said many times before, I think if they were really, really, really exposed to the reality of what they were involved in, many of them would have the courage to walk away from it. And you mentioned this person as a sort of inspirational figure in your life. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about what it was that this person did that you found so helpful or that you found so eye-opening in your, you know, your path through high school.
Well, my 10th grade English teacher, Donna Bryan, definitely was someone who cared for her students and would read each paper so thoroughly and have very specific comments. And she really also challenged the students as well to think for themselves and come up with new ideas, because I remember entering that classroom and so many people being unaware of so many things like slave labor, for instance, and she would bring that issue into her classroom and we would discuss it. And I think that she really wants young people to know that they have power as well. I remember doing an essay that she asked us how we felt as teenagers. The essay question was based around the prejudice of teenagers and how adults really viewed us. And I thought that was a very interesting assignment because that was kind of taking power into our own hands, trying to think about how we really felt and how we thought our knowledge was cherished or not. So just by giving us really interesting assignments like that showed that she wanted us to become enlightened. And also the fact that when I started to get to know her even more, I started to talk to her and realize how much crap she did have to deal with through the school system in order to just teach us. Like the videos that she would show would become controversial and, you know, she would get in trouble or whatever by the principal. But at the same time, she would still try to work around that and still fight for what she knew was right. And she would definitely also have a lot of work. And just to see all of the different things she was doing was very inspiring. And I guess, what else? I don't really know. Like, it's just the type of person she is. You could just tell that she has absolutely no evil side to her whatsoever. And she's just an incredibly kind human being. So I guess that's what drew me to her. Most teachers, you know, kind of keep to themselves and won't try to connect with students in the way that she did. And I'm sure, I think that I hear that, you know, a lot of people have that one teacher that did that for them. So I'm glad that those kind of teachers are out there.
Yeah, I think for me, I did have one, and it wasn't as much about a personal connection, but it was just it was a history teacher, which was a subject that I always hated, and he really sparked up my interest in that, and really showed me that I had abilities far beyond what I ever was led to believe that I had in high school. I think that teachers like that are really they're few and far between. And they're usually pretty easy to spot. They're usually younger, and they're less curmudgeon-y than, you know, a lot of the older teachers who are nearing retirement. You know, it's always something that I've had a little bit of difficulty with, because when I realized what school was all about, what government school was all about, and I was, you know, getting a master's degree and a certification to go and teach in that school, and when I stumbled across, you know, John Taylor Gatto and John Holt and John Cazole, I ran in the other direction, and I just said I'd find another way to do this. And, you know, fortunately, I eventually did. But I think that I try not to be disrespectful of the people who have realized that, you know, I really do care about trying to make a positive difference in the lives of these kids. And more than 90% of all the kids in this country are going to go through this system. And I want to be there. And you know, I want to try and make a difference that way. Like I said, it wasn't for me. I knew I would just be too frustrated and probably fired within a year or two of working in that system. But I think that there is another kind of courage involved in, you know, what she's doing, because of course, if she's going off the beaten path, people are fighting her and people are, you know, resisting and attacking and probably trying to make what she does a lot more difficult. Because that's not how it works. I mean, people who try to raise the bar or push the limits are usually pushed out of the system one way or another. So I think it's great that you were able to have, out of all the teachers that you had, one that really inspired you and really helped you get a sense of power and believe in yourself. Because I think that that's one more than a lot of people get to have in government school. And the only other thing that I was interested in is what are your plans next? Where are you headed next?
Well, I'm going to UBuffalo for the fall. I already have 31 credits from going to Hudson Valley Community College for my senior year. Mm-hmm. So I will be a sophomore. I have no idea what I want to major in. Honestly, it probably really doesn't matter what I major in. I don't think that a degree would really matter much. But I think I would like to learn more about the sciences like chemistry and physics. Unfortunately, none of those classes were open when I started registering for classes, so I'll do that next semester. And this semester, I'm just going to take some cool classes. There's actually a magic, witchcraft, and sorcery class, taking Chinese, you know, all these crazy things. And I guess I'll just see what, you know, university is like. Hopefully, I can continue to get messages from people who are really involved in acting for change. And I can help them out and try to work around my school schedule to do whatever, spread the word. I don't know yet. We'll see what opportunities arise.
Well, I think you certainly have made yourself, you've certainly appeared on the radar now of a lot of people who are acting for change. And I know that last night Ian Freeman invited you to come to New Hampshire, where I also am, where there are many people and, you know, new arrivals all the time acting for change. I was even asked to extend an invitation to you by one of my sponsors, a guy named Jason Osborne, who also sponsors that show Free Talk Live, and said, make sure you tell her to come to New Hampshire and check out what's going on here. You can check out this Free State project that Ian mentioned. It really is, I think, in line with a lot of the things that you're talking about. And I really hope that new people continue to reach out to you, and obviously not just to congratulate you on this excellent, inspirational, courageous speech, but also to look to you for ideas and discussion on all of these things.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I definitely am interested in the Free State project. I was looking at it a little bit. So, you know, hopefully I can make it out to New Hampshire. I'm sure I can find a weekend or something to do that.
I think, well, I'm a part of it, and there's a lot of really exciting things going on here. It really has to start with people trying to, like I said before, become aware of what has happened to them in the past through growing up, through adolescence, through school. Get honest about what all that stuff was, what all that stuff did, and really try to, you know, to set themselves free. And then we can free a state, if you know what I mean. But yeah, Eric, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and I hope in the future I can have you back to contribute School Sucks podcast. And I wish you the best of luck, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad we got in contact.
Everybody's waiting on graduation. It's high school, and it sucks. I have few friends I can trust. Man, high school, and it sucks. Why am I so out of touch? Yeah, high school, and it sucks. Man, it sucks so much. It's high school, and it sucks. Man, it sucks so much. High school, and it sucks. High school, and it sucks. Man, it sucks. Man, it sucks so much. Yeah! It sucks.
What just happened?